You only need to win a game by 1 point, said the then South African Rugby Union coach Jacques Nienaber after South Africa's tournament opener against Scotland in the 2023 Rugby World Cup. Little did he know that it would take 3 1-point games to propel the Springboks into the history books as four-time winners of the Web Ellis Cup. Twice the Glory goes deep inside the book story of that historic era. Filled with drama, cheers and tears, it'll have you on the edge of your seat as you relive each nail-biting moment. It's all here. The COVID disruption, Siya Kolisi's rise to the captaincy, Rassie in hot water over that video, injury blows and the emergence of a new talent as they head off to France. The book also includes penetrating analysis and insights from Nienaber into how this team became the finest the world has ever seen. In this episode of PageCast, Katua Lowe, sports broadcaster, sits down with authors Lloyd Bernard and Kaniso Tswaku. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the PageCast podcast, proudly brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. And I'm Katua Lowe, and today I get to talk about a topic that every South African loves so much, the Springboks. And there's a brand new book out there called Twice the Glory, The Making of the Greatest Bok Team in History, which no South African will argue about. And thanks to the two authors for being here, I'd like to welcome Lloyd Bernard, the sports editor of News24.com, as well as Kaniso Tswaku, whose first book is out as well. He is a senior sports reporter at News24.com. Gents, thank you so much for joining us today. Smiling, it must be such a relief to have this out there and it's done. Lloyd, I mean, you're a veteran. You've got two books already, but how are we feeling with this one?
Thanks, Katua. It's good to be here chatting about it. Yeah, no, exciting times. It's always a good feeling when it's wrapped up and on the shelves. But I suppose now comes the nervy wait to see how it's received. But no, we're both very chuffed, very excited about it. Yeah, so let's see what happens.
Kaniso, congratulations, your first book. And you got to work with a colleague, because that's not, you know, we all have colleagues, but we don't always want to, you know, write books with them. So how was it working with Lloyd and getting this on the shelf?
No, it was, firstly, thank you very much. No, it was a lack experience. It's a very good experience. I mean, fortunately, he's not a first-time book writer, so that helps significantly. You can imagine if we're first-time book writers now trying to furrow through the mechanics and the technicalities of writing a book. Fortunately, that helped significantly, but it also gave me a bird's eye view into how difficult it is writing a book. There are people who do it repeatedly. At some point when I was done, I was asking myself a question, how do people do this repeatedly? Every 18 months, they've got a book out. Every 18 months, they've got a book out. But look, I've learned how much work goes into a book. It's a valuable experience, probably, and it's experience that will hold me in good stead going forward should another project like this come up.
Before we delve into the book completely, which I really, really enjoyed, I love how the facts were sort of weaved into the emotions we felt here, because, you know, not all of us were at the Rugby World Cup in France specifically, how you merged those facts with the emotions we felt as South Africans. But Kaniso, you had quite a nice thing here by your acknowledgement saying, lastly, to all my teachers, I hope this is something close to the potential you saw in me. Have we had any response from the teachers there?
Not yet. I do need to understand that most of my teachers are retired at the moment. I'm trying to think. I think there's only one of them I can think clearly still teaching, Mr. Gina Portrex. Yeah, look, I mean, a lot of them tried to get the potential out and failed. Some tried to beat it out of me. They did better than others. Some had a very soft touch and it worked. So, I mean, there's a particular teacher, Mrs. Fundamara, she taught at Portrex, then she finished off at Hudson. She was very good in actually encouraging me to give English the seriousness it deserved. That, pretty much here's the end result.
Well, that's good. You know, us East Londoners, we need to stick together. Wershko Grenz has not heard any book mumblings from me just yet. So I'll take, hopefully you can inspire me for... Whiskey, Whiskey, Gymnasium. Whiskers Gymnasium, yes. Sorry, RIP Grant, but we representing in some way there. Because, I mean, I guess these teachers are like our coaches, the people that get us started and all those things.
Yep.
Lloyd, I guess, what made you start or get into this side of it? Because as Kaniso said, it's quite a big thing to tackle, writing a book. And this is your, I mean, you co-authored Nick Mallett's one last year, which I also enjoyed very much. And now this one's your third one. So, I mean, why take this on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always in the back of your mind when for all of us who start out in particularly sports journalism, you know, we're so lucky and we get to, you know, travel the world and get to these places that so many South African sports fans, you know, would love to be in. And we're very privileged in that sense. And I think it's always for all of us in the back of, certainly for me starting out, you know, a book somewhere down the line as you grow and become more experienced in the industry is something you'd like to do. And I was just incredibly fortunate. And I must give the world of credit to my editor at News24, Adrian Besson, for pushing me in that direction after the 2019 World Cup. And it was very daunting back then. And it was really ignited by the opportunity I had to join the Springboks on that 5-day trophy tour when I followed them around the country and just saw South Africa in this incredible, incredible space. And it was very moving. And I remember sitting with Adrian in Johannesburg as that tour was beginning. And he said, listen, you're going to see some things over the next 5 days that are going to stay with you for the rest of your life. This is going to be one of the stories of your career. And I think you should write the book. And I said, but I wasn't at the World Cup in Japan. And he said, but you're here on the ground when it matters, seeing South Africa react this way. And then that started the process, and Jonathan Ball backed that project, which I'm very proud of now, a few years later. It took a long time for me to reach that stage, but now in hindsight, looking back, very proud of that project. And then the Nick relationship was one that we had through News24 when he wrote columns for us. And, again, that was Jeremy at Jonathan Ball going, listen, we've got this idea around Nick ahead of the 2023 World Cup. What do you reckon you could do? How quickly could you do it? And then, you know, Nick's so easy to work with anyway. So that one kind of just happened organically too. And then this was just a completely different experience as well, because, you know, the first one is a complete solo project. It's just me. The second one I'm doing, it's Nick's book more, you know, it's not mine. I'm just helping him out. And then this one, sharing it with Kaniso, who was fantastic from start to finish. And the obvious strength there was, you know, his vivid recollections of being on the ground with the Springboks throughout the 2023 World Cup. And that was such an important element in this project. I don't think, you know, I can do this book without having, you know, that firsthand account and the beautiful recollections of everything that happened over there. So, you know, long story short, I suppose it was always something that's in the back of your mind in terms of taking that plunge into a different space in the industry. But there was no long-term plan or vision in terms of, you know, wanting to keep doing them. I think it's just been, you know, right place, right time, and the stars kind of aligning it. You know, if the Springboks don't win the last two World Cups, then there's probably no books. It's
a different type of book. So you also made, you had a nickname just now for Kaniso, because I need to, what is your nickname for Kaniso?
Oh, no, it's, we all just call him Trucks in the newsroom. So it's the S replaces the U at the end of his surname. Mari Levita from Netflix asked me the same question yesterday.
Because it won't be sport or rugby if there aren't any nicknames. So I just needed to know that this, it's a valid one to be in it now. Kaniso, because I guess it's your first one, and how is writing something like this? What is this book about? How is it different to, I guess, an article you'll publish or a research you do for one thing? What's going on into this in terms of that?
To answer the nickname part, Trucks is just one of at least, I'll say a minimum 10 nicknames I have. I have nicknames for wherever I've walked in life. So this is just one of probably the easier ones. Look, it's quite different, weird, and exciting in that you have to recall everything that happened. And, you know, when you walk through a World Cup, you take a tournament, for example, which was my first World Cup. Just not my first global event. My first global event was the 2013 Champions Trophy. Every day is an adventure. It's just a case of how do you memorize that adventure. There were days that every day had something in it, whether it was a slow day, whether it was a fast day. Every day had something. So just always trying to piece together what happened on a particular day. I'll use the example of Malcolm Marx's injury. They was quite, we were quite upset that morning because they changed the time of the practice. And we only had that 15-minute viewing session. So none of us were able to make it because it was on another side of Toulon Town at the campus. We were so accustomed to catching the ferry across the Bock Hotel. We now needed to learn to catch the bus to the other side of town, and we just couldn't do that within the space of a day. And it turned out that session we missed was we weren't going to be able to watch that injury for obvious reasons. But that session we did not attend, that 15 minutes, was the one where Malcolm got injured. And that probably was the only training 15-minute visit session I missed throughout the World Cup. So like every day had its own story, even if something didn't happen in the day. And I think because I took in each day as it came and treated each day as an adventure, it became quite easy to recollect and then just put everything that I remembered into words.
I don't think too many people can do that. You know, those who've worked with Trucks and know him can attest to the fact that he's this kind of walking encyclopedia of stats and facts and sporting knowledge. I mean, there's stuff from decades ago that he remembers, you know, as if it happened yesterday, and he can pull up just some incredible stats and facts. So I think, you know, when you're at a World Cup and it's all happening all the time so frantically around you, I don't think many people would be able to kind of, you know, it's almost like a photographic type memory that this guy has with recalling these things in such detail. So he's not giving himself enough credit there for how difficult I think it is to retell those stories in such detail.
Is it the chemical engineering degree that's helping with the retainment of knowledge?
The mathematics did a number on me there, I can tell you right now. What it did help was that I grew up being quite an avid reader. Newspapers were a staple of my growing up through a late friend of my mom's. Who used to parade me like a show person, like, read the story to us. It was Dr. Masaudi, his first name escapes me, but my mom often tells that he used to parade me in front of his friends. This kid can read. So he used to give me the newspaper, and I'd have to read the newspaper. Like, even if I didn't understand the topic, I was able to read and just explain the story to them. And that's how I got into reading. But I remember my late uncle was the one person who actually not forced me, but if everyone was, my late uncle was the eldest at home. So if he walked in and someone was watching the news, he would change the channel, and no one actually argued with him. My late grandmother would argue, Valtuba, what are you doing? Like, mommy, I'm watching. And that's how I actually started to watch sport regularly. So I suspect that I may have slightly grown up with sporting images in my mind.
Ah, okay. And also being able to explain that, which, I mean, makes all the more sense. So I can't wait for future books, Kaniso, if that's the photographic memory we are working with. Lloyd, you've been in newsrooms multiple times, Kaniso as well. I just want you to put us in, for those that don't know, I guess, how a media day with a box work or with a high-profile team, because Kaniso, you said you missed one 15-minute training session, but Lloyd, how can you put us as a normal person, like just in what a journalist goes through, let's say with the box in terms of a media week, so we can understand what you're allowed to see and what you're not allowed to see or and where the boundaries are, I guess, but also trying to figure out where the story is.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, your whole aim, if you treat it week by week, so a BOC week will start on a Monday. You know, you'll have your designated media slots throughout the week, your standard press conferences where they put up various coaches and players throughout the week. And then, as Trucks was saying earlier, you've got your designated training sessions where you actually spend some time with the players and watch them train. The real challenge that's all the kind of bread and butter stuff. You know, you follow the side and you attend all the press conferences and you attend all the training sessions and you report all the news. You know, the real goal and aim of following the box when you're with them, as Kaniso did at the World Cup and on the end of your tour last year, is to really delve deeper and get the stories kind of happening underneath that kind of surface level. So, you know, you want to base yourselves close to where they are. You want to be around the team hotel. themselves. You want to be having chats to players and coaches, you know, outside of the allocated sessions. And you want to get to a place where you can really tell your readers the story of what's going on in the camp that week beyond just what's presented in press conferences. That's the real aim. You know, what's actually going on here? What are the Bucks looking at doing this week? Who's struggling with this or that? Or what are they expecting? What's the chat? Where are they staying? How's everyone feeling? You know, you really want to bring the week to life. And I suppose that's, you know, the challenge with a project like this as well. You know, you want to go a bit deeper than simply telling the everyone knows we won the three quarterfinals by 1 point. Everyone watched the game. Yeah. We've all, you know, watched the 80 minutes, but we want to be in a position where we can give you a bit more and take you a bit deeper into what actually happened at the tournament. And I think that's where, you know, it was so imperative having the voice of a person who was intimately in that camp for the duration of the tournament, like Kanisa was. I mean, there's some stories that he tells throughout the book where you, I mean, I wasn't at the World Cup myself, but I feel like I was in that press conference room when Sia comes walking in with Jacques Nienaber and, you know, the trophy and them erecting the world champion sign. You know, you feel like you're there, and that's because of the storytelling. And I think that's a common theme throughout the book. And then obviously Jacques Nienaber, who spoke to us, you know, exclusively for the purposes of this book, was just hugely valuable as well. And that really gives you that level of insight and detail in terms of what was happening in the camp, not just at the World Cup, but really over the 6 years from 2018 to now, that made it the, as we say, the, you know, the greatest box side in history.
I think just add on to what Louis said, it's probably the key part of such a project is that people will know the results, but they want to understand what actually goes into the construction of a double World Cup winning team. But also the key moment is that how do you sum that up in a book that won't bore them? I really hope that they'll be caught in and just gain a bigger view, because one of the biggest things I learned from the book is actually learning how Jacques Nienaber thinks as a person. Because yeah. I think he's probably one of the most underrated rugby thinkers. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that of the coaches, his rugby playing background is the weakest. And in speaking to him about his background and how he got into rugby, probably then informed the fact that as much as rugby is a game that is learned on the field, you actually learn more about the human being off the field through the game of rugby. I actually, when I was done speaking to him, I was like, I somehow wished I would have done that interview when he first became Springbok coach, because I would have had an even better understanding of how Jacques thinks. And I've always respected him as a human being and as a rugby person. But after that interview, I actually left that interview with even more respect, because I then came to glean and understand how much of his life he's dedicated to the game. Outside of him just being a qualified physiotherapist, you can see that he lives, breathes, eats the game. And then, like, I mean, when he explained the fact that when the other team was celebrating World Cup, he just needed to sleep, it just spoke of the magnitude of the effort that he put in. But even then, he was already thinking about his next project and not just the World Cup success on its own.
Lloyd, you mentioned that, I mean, that first page gripped me as well, like saying how they changed the world champion sign, and then also all the journalists, because, I mean, that objectivity and unemotionalness you have to maintain throughout something like that, how you also had a glint in your eye. I guess how, and having Nienaber sit down with you now for this project, how do you maintain that, I guess, relationship or build that relationship if, Lloyd, you say that you have to go sort of above and beyond and sort of see the between the cracks, what's going on, and that might, for lack of a better term, piss off some people in a camp or in a team behind the scenes. So I guess maybe both of you can answer this, is how do you keep that objectivity but also have a relationship?
I think in this case, it's just such a positive story, you know. So there's not going to be too much that anyone who was involved in the greatest success in Springbok rugby, there's not too much they can say that's going to, you know, cast anyone in a negative light or anything like that. So I think that's always helpful. You know, we're not telling the story of 2015 and 2016. And if we were doing that and speaking to players and coaches, it might be a different story, because those were obviously tough times. But when you're recalling a golden period of two World Cups and a British Lions, you know, series win, then I think that makes it easier. Look, I mean, I've had my own tests over the years of maintaining that kind of objectivity. And I mean, one of my pet hates in press boxes when I'm watching live games is when journalists applaud and cheer tries. It's just something that's always from the John Bishop School of rugby journalism, is something that I've never really enjoyed. I'm old like that, I think. But I think in that moment, you know, you would have allowed yourself a moment to kind of soak it all in and just turn into a normal South African for those few moments, as all of the South African journalists in that room did that day. I mean, the World Cup trophy is there, the caps is there, Jacques is there. It's a double World Cup win. I think you wouldn't be South African if you didn't have a moment to, you know, take your journalistic hat off and just soak in the experience as a South African. But when it comes to the process of speaking to these guys and Jacques was brilliant. You know, for the interview, he was just so good, really giving us those details and didn't really hold back, you know, was kind of very prepared to tell us as it was, which was refreshing and I think made for a very honest, emotional, passionate, you know, take on what happened. But yeah, I mean, the balance between, you know, being a South African rugby follower and a journalist and author, I think is something we always have to be mindful of. Yeah.
Can you so?
Look, that is probably the one moment where we allowed ourselves to breathe a bit. What I didn't explain was the joy that a lot of guys were having in the press box, because I can say it now, Jan de Koning walked around with comfortably the biggest Cheshire Cat grin I've ever seen from a journalist. And like, I kind of, when I saw him being as happy as he is, he made a point of not reminding, but the World Cup for him, if I'm not mistaken, was his first overseas trip since 1994. Wow. And that was to Wales and all. And remember, those were proper old school tours where they played on weekends or dirt tracker games. And I mean, that was pretty much not even, that's probably an entirety of my life where Jan has been working in the rugby space and yet had never actually been to an external World Cup and covered the one in South Africa in 1995. And to see him as happy as he was, it kind of then dawned on me how special that moment was. I mean, for someone like Adnan has covered, say, several World Cups, and he was as happy as if he'd watched his first World Cup win. And Valen, I just could tell my colleagues, I mean, even Liam Dokam, like, even though he cut a sturdy figure, you could see that how, and he was at Yokohama in 2019. You could see how much it meant to him. So when we looked at each other in the press box, I mean, Hendrik was also at three World Cups that I remember. It was 2015, 2019. When they were changing that livery, because we'd see that livery throughout, that red livery, we'd see that throughout the World Cup. They didn't even change it for the third place playoff. But now for the final, they changed it. It was like, okay, now this is quite special. I actually have a picture of that livery being changed. I was like, okay, now the winners are coming. And only then it really started to sing that something special here has really been achieved. And then when you could hear Sia humming in the background, there was a then it just hushed. That was his moment. That was their moment. And they were allowed to take in that moment in the manner that was fitting for them.
To add to a pet peeve, Lloyd, is probably from my perspective, is when in a press conference, you know, a journalist or a reporter goes and grabs a photo with a player or the coach or
don't
the
get
whatever.
Me started.
100%. Okay. But can you saw there is a photo in this book where you and the rest of South African contingent are with Sia and Jacques. So you really let yourself go there, hey?
No, we were called for that picture. We were called. We were especially called to take that picture, because I think also one of the things we had in mind is that with the economic situation that we find ourselves in, I'm of the major country. We're comfortably the smallest traveling contingent. So if there was a pop game, you always saw us there. So we literally operated as a family when we were there. So when, I mean, we were there for, in the England semi-final, we felt as outnumbered in the press box as the fans were, the Bok fans were, in the stadium. So it felt hostile. It felt like an away game. And it's probably the one game where we tacitly and quietly agreed on the train back that that was the one game that we were not supposed to lose because we're never going to hear the end of it. But, I mean, it was probably one of those moments where we've won a World Cup in 2019. It was probably a breakthrough moment considering what had transpired in the 2 years leading into that tournament. But when you look at the fact that this is a World Cup that was constructed within 3 years, not even a three-year cycle, not even a four-year cycle, three-year cycle, we were like, this is quite a moment. And probably this is a moment in sport that may not happen again, because if there is another pandemic, the world will be able to react to it far better than they did in 2020. Mm. So when we looked at that moment, then you looked at how Jacques tried to keep his excitement and enjoyment of the lowdown. But you look at that photo, you look at his eyes, that is the look of a happy man. And we were happy, yes, because I mean, for all that had transpired, that 3 weeks, we were the coal face of 3 1-point wins. And we had to go through another 1-point win where, if let's say the margin of success or the margin of defeat was wide, it would have been a bigger release of tension. But the fact that we had to live through those 3 weekends, like we had to catch that train from east of Paris, to be honest, I haven't told this part of so that we couldn't find a train back to our place. We had to wait for a bus to arrive. And the bus took a joyride. I think I got back to the hotel around 4 a.m. And I mean, the press conferences ended at around just past 1:15. And we sat there and waited and waited and waited for a bus to come. So, I mean, you look back at that moment and arriving in the hotel, dredge, you're like, you know what? That moment, I won't tell the story before, after, but that picture mattered.
Is that why it took a year? Because your heart's only calmed down now, Kaniso. It's only just settled, like after.
Look, it settled a bit when I arrived, because as soon as I landed, I had to do the Pretoria Joburg leg of the trophy tour, and only then it kind of dawned on me. And the one thing I hated the most was that I left a cold Paris and arrived to a cold Johannesburg. And I was like, where's the summer now? Because now I was like, the only thing I really missed was the weather. Like, I was like, I could do another week in Paris. But okay, I got a bit tired of the cold weather. But I think the key part was that as I landed, and the sore part was we missed the landing because someone in Nairobi decided to go walk about at the airport. Had we left on time, would have arrived on time. It would have arrived with the Springboks, would have been filing through customs at the same time. And so some errant human being decided to cost us a moment. I sat next to Bismarck's wife on the flight and she was absolutely fuming because someone decided to hold us up at the airport. We were delayed by 2 hours. By the time we arrived, everything had died down. So had we caught, they would have actually captured the moment walking in behind them. But look, the trophy tour settled me down significantly because then I was able to see what it meant to people, what it meant. Mm. I mean, you look at those government ministers, I've never seen them so excited. They were giddy, giddy, giddy as kids. And I was there when they were walking around with Banyana Banyana. I was there in 2019. And I think for some of them, it was a second success. I was like, this thing happened again. So It settled down. I remember when I got home, I was welcomed by my kids and my partner. They were so happy to see me. But I think it settled down gradually. When I went home, people called me a World Cup winner. I was like, guys, I didn't do anything, but you were there. You were right. So I think just the moment of being there, I think one of the key things, and I'll say it, one of the key things we live for as journalists, especially as sports journalists, you want to have your I was there moment. Even if it comes once in a lifetime, if you have your I was there moment. I mean, often joke with our colleague, Simkla Madisa, that he was at Twickenham in 2002 and South Africa lost 53-3. And that was his bad I was there moment. Actually, 4 years later, he went to Brisbane, he was there for 49-0. But he was there in Paris a year later when they won the World Cup. I was in Albany for 57-0. I was in Durban for 57-15. So I think sometimes it just works in weird cycles where you always have your bad moment and you have your good moment. I think at some point, Lloyd deserves his good cricket moment because he was at the 2019 World Cup where everything started badly and it just didn't work out until it ended. So hopefully in 2027, the graces will grant him a South African World Cup win.
Okay, Lloyd, your turn, Jerome. Because the making of the greatest Bok team in history is a big title. So I guess now I want to know, when did you start believing, I guess, like the Rasi and the Enamas believed in when they put down in the systems, they made bold choices, all those things. Is there ever a point where you went, Lloyd, geez, this is a great team. This team's going to be a historic, like memorable. We're always going to talk about this team. Was there ever a moment? Can you remember the moment?
Look, 6 years is a long time. And I think this story exactly. is... And I think that the story is probably as the trophies are the trophies and the World Cups are the World Cups, but it's also about where they came from. And I always feel for Alistair in those 2 years because he was such a very good coach at franchise level, and those Bok years should have really turned out differently for him. But you know, the Boks were in a bad place when Rasi and Jacques arrived. So I think that's what kind of you know, if you start at that point, at that low, and you know, the famous seventh in the world, you know, quote that we use all the time, and then you look at the next 6 years and you know, the two World Cups, the British and Irish Lions series win. What's the turning point? Probably the Wellington win trucks before 2019, that one on the road, Peter Steph Du Toit in tears, is probably that day. You know, the famous images of Peter Steph crying, they've finally beaten the All Blacks on the road. There's a clear indication on that day that something's happening here, and that going into 2019, potentially something special could happen. Then obviously 2019 happens and they win it. And it's you know, the most famous moment already at that stage in the history of Bok rugby, given where they came from. Then if you look at the fact that they went into a British Lions series ice cold, with all home advantage stripped away from them, playing in front of an empty Cape Town stadium. And, you know, having been at those tests, I can recall just how eerie it was just out of COVID and, you know, silence and sounds of flesh and on flesh echoing through the stands. It really wasn't, you know, what you would expect. Absolutely no home ground advantage at all there in a Lions series. And the fact that they come back and that huge players like Sia Kolisi stand up with massive moments, you know, big turnovers to keep them in the series. Mornay Steyn, you know, these guys kind of getting them over the line in that game. I mean, what an incredible effort to beat a very, very hungry British Lions touring side who were desperate to win that series, and to find a way to get over the line there, where, as I say, they were ice cold and had played absolutely no international rugby, was amazing. And then going into 2023, by this point now, they've created this just massive depth in player quality where the Boks can field two starting 15s and probably compete with any side in the world with either of them entering 2023 as favorites because of what they've all achieved over the last 5 years. You've got just these players that have developed through incredible game management from the coaches and, you know, planning and attention to detail. You've got guys that have gone from 10 caps to 20 to 30 to 40 who are now world beaters in their position. You know, just the way this whole process unfolded. But if you look at the starting point, what it was like when they came in, what the lay of the land was, and you look at it now, you look at what it was when Jacques left at the end of the 2023 World Cup. I mean, you know, what are the other contenders here? You've probably got the 95 side, which is the famous, you know, one of our crowning South Africa sporting moments. You've got Jake's 2007 side that was flawless at that World Cup. You've got, you know, Mallet's 17 in a row Bok side that was a record at the time. But I mean, when the guy who's won 17 in a row tells you that, you know, it's not even close, that this is the greatest Bok side of all time. And I think, you know, and I mean, you know, we could have pushed the title trucks. We could have actually said maybe it was the making of the greatest rugby side of all time. Because, I mean, I don't think that's there'd be a lot of heated debates around that. But I'm sure you could make your arguments for that as well.
And your belief moment, you're like, this is the greatest team in we've got. So when was your moment?
There are a few, not.
Of course, you've got stories for days, Joe.
2018 and Wellington 2019. Remember that South Africa historically don't do back to back well in New Zealand. But when they beat them in Wellington in 2018, it felt like a yoke had been lifted. To hold them in 2019, that's when I realized that there's something on with the World Cup. Yes, the All Blacks won again in Yokohama, but it's probably the defeat that reminded everyone that New Zealand are human. Then the British and Irish line series was just something else. But I think the one game that really dawned on me that, yeah, there's something really special to work with was the Bock test against France in Marseille in 2022, where the Bocks with 13 men kept France at bay. And France needed some assistance from Wayne Bond to win that game. And I think I do explain what actually transpired on that Saturday night in Marseille. I won't talk about the laundry not arriving that week, but that's another story for another day. The key thing was that the bet in the Bocks, I think, when they looked at that game, because Marseille historically has been a place where South Africa, outside of World Cups, have generally struggled to beat France. It was one of those nights where they couldn't beat France. But France, with a packed stadium, probably one of the best sides, couldn't get past a 13, 14-man Bock team. It probably shook their belief, and it informed how the Bocks were actually going to go about their quarterfinal, which in hindsight was probably the best quarterfinal draw we could get, because a wounded New Zealand side is a dangerous side. And Eben, regardless of how the Irish feel about what he said, Eben was absolutely correct that you can never write off New Zealand. And initially, I was one of those who were happy that we may probably draw New Zealand because it's probably the blockbuster quarterfinal that the rugby world wants. But with Clive Woodward probably screaming out of his chest that it's time for Northern Hemisphere dominance. And then by the time that Super Sunday ended, there was only one Northern Hemisphere team that remained. And even then, they were actually fortunate to remain in the semifinals. I look back at the two France games for me, having experienced them in living color in the flesh, in being in Marseille that November night where the Bocks were unlucky. And then with fortune favoring them because, I mean, you know, leaving the Stade de France that night and seeing all those glum faces, especially with what we experienced in Marseille, we're like, yeah, well, look, life is tricky. But if I look at a game where I think that where I realize that the Bocks were something special, Marseille 2022 was the one game where I say, yeah, we've got something to work with.
No, I was saying we didn't even mention Twickenham, you know, before the World Cup and the birth of 7-1. I mean, on that day, it's you know, if can't be a clearer sign of a team that's about to, you know, win a World Cup than what they did to the All Blacks at Twickenham that day.
Yeah, because I mean, yeah, you weave these stories so beautifully into this specific book, and that's what I like specifically stood out for me was those. And you also go back to the right fact to give more context to the story you are actually telling, Lloyd and Kaniso. So that's very, very cool. And that British Irish Lions series for me was also, it was just so unique and just that bone crunching. You could hear it literally reflect into this. It was insane. Like, and yeah, that they got through that in their hotel rooms, basically. Anyway, so that for me was a very big one as well. I agree. Mm. But just being in France, absolutely epic, Kaniso. I need to know how. We've saw it on TV, we saw it hearing it from people, but how volatile were the French towards South Africans and then also South African media? Because you have your own little schedule compared to a fan, which can you know, like a champagne can drink or a birki there or something, but like you have to go also file and stuff and be in a room with those media, French media specifically. And then also you mentioned English media. So how was that?
Yeah. Look, they were sour after the quarterfinal. They were sour. I was a butt of the jokes in the build-up because I then, knowing that Gregory Aldri speaks reasonable English, I then popped a question in English and they joked about it. And then I think there's also, remember that in France, a lot of dark-skinned people speak French and, in South Africa, it doesn't work like that because the French language isn't a language of operation. Yeah. So when I popped that question and they joked about it and they laughed, and I was like, yeah, it does sound a bit funny, but it also, there was an element of ridiculing because, I mean, it cannot be their assumption that I actually can speak French. I can't. So when we then sat down, I mean, Antoine Dupont went on a proper rant about the refereeing. And it's something that Rassie had actually talked about, that they will stop talking about the unfair decisions. They will find ways to meet the referees halfway. And one of the key things that they changed, especially after Genoa, was when Rassie was banned, was that they cut conversations about match officials. And it was so... it was so ironic to hear a Northern Hemisphere team complaining about being shafted by a match official. And I was like, hey, you often joke about, we say, what goes around comes around. We actually shortened it in colloquial, what goes around comes around. So they were on the short end of the stick with the fish eating. They were not happy. This thing, I mean, listening to, I remember, it's a pity that Anton didn't speak English, but just listening to him just go on and on and on and on about the officiating. I was like, 2 years ago, South Africa was on the same tip. But then again, it teaches you about the cycle of life. Well, if it happens to another team, it will happen to you. And it just so far that there was an entitlement from the French leading into that week, watching the news bulletins, that this was their World Cup to win. I mean, the backstory of South Africa actually playing France the World Cup with that loss but make that game all the more spicier. And the fact that France at home just don't do well in Paris for World Cups and knockout games at home. So a bit of that history was lost to them because they felt, having beaten South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, build up, that this was their time. And the fact that now they had to leave their own party when it just started did have an element of satisfaction.
Ah, it must be so satisfying. You were there, Tom. You were there in the midst of it. I absolutely love that. And that's how I felt reading this. I felt like I was there. So thank you very much for putting this together. Just lastly, Lloyd, just in terms of this book and being, you know, just a general South African, who do you think would find, you know, appeal from this book? And why would you suggest that this is a good one to read, whatever your level of rugby knowledge or sporting knowledge at that, for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's for absolutely everybody. I mean, you know, if you have any remote interest in South African rugby and the Springboks, which feels like absolutely everybody in the country at the moment, then yeah, I think this book's for you. I think it has everything. It's got some really. It allows you to relive, you know, those golden weeks of both World Cups, of the Lions series, of the whole cycle under Rassi and Jacques. Like we said, a lot happens in 6 years. So it's a nice opportunity to go back and take that walk through the 6 years and just remind yourself of exactly what happened. But it's also got some really fantastic insights from Jacques Nienaber himself, who takes you into that camp and tells you some fantastic stories about, you know, what actually transpired along the way, from him and Rassi watching the Box lose in Ireland before they took the job on, and what that day was like for them, from, you know, Felix Jones, and, you know, how Jacques got into defense coaching by studying the Crusaders in the unbeaten 2002 season. There's lots of little stories like that, that keep you interested. And it's also just some really good, as I said, one of the strong elements is having someone who was on the ground with the Box at the World Cup, retelling those moments so vividly. So I think it's got your emotional recollections. It's beautifully written by Caniso in some places. Hopefully some decent writing from myself as well in some places. And yeah, I think the analysis from Jacques and kind of that level of detail means that there's something for everyone here for sure.
And I mean, just how you were speaking today, Caniso, is the vividness is in that book. So I hope, I'm sure a lot of people will enjoy it, more than enough will enjoy it. Just, can I use the last one to you? Because you've delved into all of this, you know, you mentioned the 7-1 split there earlier, Lloyd, and all these almost shocking, surprising things that has happened in this era. Is there anything that still can shock you, can you say?
Hey, with Dr. Erasmus, you can never know. It's one of the bigger takeouts of the book. You can never know. You can never know what he's planning. I think one of the things that I learned from Jacques, and hopefully one of the takeouts that I hope readers can get outside of everything else that Lloyd has explained, is that rugby is a way of life. People just see the end product. And what we try to do as writers every day is to explain what we see and explain what we hear from people who are close to the camps. Because there's so much that goes into a match day. I mean, Lloyd just brushes over the top when he says, you have the normal match week. One of the things I realized at the World Cup, where you're at the hotel, you see them packing all the stuff. It's a monumental task. It's a monumental task. So we were the spectators, and rather than to use the words that Lloyd used, you are our eyes and ears and our voice at the World Cup. It's probably one of the most humbling experiences I've ever had. I mean, at some point, we had a shout out, and I actually was heading to a press conference, and my colleagues were so I was actually Royal Cross, and my colleagues were so happy to see me there. And it kind of dawned on me how important the job was. for me, and not just for me, but representing the country. Because as much as we maybe represent the company, when you're in that position, you also represent the country. You need to carry yourself in a manner that is representative of the country. So as much as the box, we always felt that we will represent the country. And I hope that the book adequately and well explains what I saw, and hopefully the reader will see what I saw and actually experience what we experienced. Because, I mean, if you walk through the 6 years, I experienced a lot of that 6 years. I was at different points of that 6 years. Some of them I was a spectator, and some of them I was a passive spectator. At some point, I was an active spectator. So I hope that the book will actually just paint the picture of the past 6 years, and then also opens them up to what exciting chapter lies ahead for the next three, hopefully to another 6 years of Bok rugby glory.
Oh, imagine twice the glory. What do you call it? Thrice the glory then, for if the next one comes out, eh?
Yeah.
I can also not imagine anyone being a passive fan, Kani. So that's shocking. That's the most shocking thing you've said today. A passive fan in South Africa. Yeah. What of order. But thank you so much, James. Lloyd Kaniso, the authors of Twice the Glory, The Making of the Greatest Bok Team in History. Of course, if you want this book to delve deeper into it and hear some of those fascinating insights, it's in bookstores everywhere and online as well. So thank you very much. That's the PageCast episode for today.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.